This show is brought to you by The Makery, the podcast network for makers.
You ready?
Yep.
Guys, guess who's here? Fox River Blades, Jaden Schubert's here, and I'm so excited to talk to him. But before we get to it, got to take care of a little business. You know what I'm saying? First things first, I want to thank my friends at Broadbeck Ironworks, makers of the 2x72 grinder. This is a great grinder. I swear by it. I have a couple of them, and they've made my life a lot better. One of the reasons why is because they're just very user-friendly, and the customer service from Broadbeck is undeniable. Great. Ryan and Ben and all those guys, they're incredible at their job. They made a beautiful grinder with great attachments, very user-friendly, and if you don't have one of their grinders and you want to get some of their attachments, they're very retrofittable. So go to BroadbeckIronworks.com, and you guess what? You get 10% off if you use the promo code KNIFETALK10. So definitely get involved with Broadbeck. I am 100% with them. I want to thank my friends at Evenheat, manufacturers of the finest heat treat ovens available. To find your next oven, go to evenheat-chillin.com. It is amazing. It is totally amazing. And if you're heat treating, you need an even heat. If you're trying to get your knives hardened, if you're going to try to hammers, tools, if you need to get it heat treated, or if you're a glass blower and you need a steady temperature, this is for you. So go to evenheat-chillin.com and get yourself squared away. Next are my friends at Maritime Knife Supply, manufacturers of... Well, they're not manufacturers. Let me tell you something. Let me tell you, they're facilitators. Maritime Knife Supply is your one-stop shop for knife-making needs. Belts, abrasives, steels, kilns, forged press, heat treating ovens, all that stuff. He's in Canada, but Lawrence is amazing. He's got what you need. He's also a knife maker. Like a lot of these places, they're just like looking for that quick buck. He knows what you need because he needs it too. So I would highly suggest getting involved with Lawrence. And if you're in Canada and you want to support a great business, definitely go to Canada. Go to maritimeknifesupply.com. And then you can also get 10 pack of abrasive belts. You get 10% off. I get my belts. I get a lot of my belts from Maritime Knife Supply. I just got a big order from him. And I'm a huge fan of Lawrence. I spent a lot of time with him. And he is just terrific. And he's a super supporter of the Center for Metal Arts and the New England School of Metalwork. And that's, you know, really important to me. So definitely go check out MaritimeKnifeSupply.com. Next are my friends at Trojan Horse Forge, makers of the stable rail knife finishing vise, makers of knives, teaching of classes. They're unbelievable. They have the T4 Sentinel oil. This stuff is awesome. So if you go to Texas, you go to TrojanHorseForge.com and you put in the promo code FULLBLAST10, you get 10% off everything. So definitely get involved. They have a great knife vise. I love it. I'm a huge fan, and those guys are really great. Speaking of great guys, the sponsors, I have relationships with all of them, and they're fantastic. And these are really people that I believe in, like Baker Forge. Go to BakerForge.com, Baker Forge and Tool on Instagram for all your exotic steels. If you want the copper, my bronze, my sand, my mosaic, Damascus, all that stuff, you definitely got to go to Baker Forge. And then if you put in the promo code FULLBLAST, you get 10% off your order, which is awesome. And then they hold your hand. They're exotic steels. They'll hold your hand on heat treating, cutting. If you're a stock removal guy, this has got your name all over it. This is ready for you. All annealed, ready to use your saw, your grinders. It's all squared away. And then when it's time to etch it, you got to use that gator piss. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. GATOR PISS. Gator short for alligator, piss short for urine. This is the best stuff to get your steel etched. And they have two new products. They have Gator Piss Heavy and Gator Piss Max. Gator Piss Max is for stainless steel. Damascus, like using that damaged steel, using that stainless steel clad Baker Forge. Got to use that bit. You know, no more. No, out of the days of the muriatic acid, you know, bombing your shop out. Get yourself some of that Gator Piss Max, and then the Gator Piss Heavies for that deep dark etch on a lot of different steels. Definitely get that. And you can get your Gator Piss and other stuff like Rhino Wet, all that stuff, at Texas Farrier Supply. Go to TexasFarrierSupply.com, put in the promo code KNIFETALK10, you're going to get 10% off everything. I get my Rhino Wet from Texas Farrier Supply. Evan and those guys have been the supporters of Knife Talk and Full Blast for a long time, and they're great. They're terrific. So I highly suggest getting yourself some Baker Forge. You can get the Baker Forge stuff, get that 10% off of Full Blast, Or you go to Texas Farrier Supply for the Gator Piss and other stuff, and you put in the promo code KNIFETALK10. Now, I know a lot of you saying, well, what is that again? Once in a while, somebody will listen saying, you were talking. This is unbelievable, Jaden. Once in a while, somebody will call me, they'll send me a message saying, I was listening to the podcast and you were referring to something. And it's like, I'm like your butler all of a sudden. But if you, all the show notes have all the information. So wherever you're listening to this, all the show notes have the hyperlinks and the deals. So definitely go to the wherever you're listening to this and check it out. Number five is my friends at Total Boat, totalboat.com/fullblast for all your adhesive, paints, primers, polishing compounds. For boaters and DIYers, they know that they need your project to go smoothly. I'm a huge fan of the Total Boat two-part epoxy. The UV cure resin, the Fathom Thick set is awesome. I just opened up another couple jugs of that two-part epoxy, and I can't get enough. They have the specially formulated dyes. It's amazing, very easy to work with, and they'll send you more cork containers than you think you'll ever need, which is nice, real nice. So definitely go to totalboat.com/fullblast, and if you're going to Maker Camp, I'm going to be doing something with them. I don't know what we're doing yet, but we're working on it. So definitely check us out. I'll be at the Total Boat tent for a little bit, and totalboat.com/fullblast. Next, my friends at GL Hansen & Sons, that's the makers of G-Carta, gcarta.bigcartel.com. G-Carta, what's G-Carta? It's a unique composite of natural fibers and fabrics mixed under epoxy with pressure and heat. Bofa, Ripple Cut, Tuxini, Mahi Mahi, Radio Worm, G-Carta, Pheasant, Colorama, Hoopla. This is all these amazing names for all these amazing products. If you're a knife maker and you're looking to put some razzle-dazzle in your ding-dong, this is the one for you. And if you go to gcarter.bigcartel.com, you can check out what he's got. I'm getting messages of people who are constantly saying, I mean, Jared Thatcher, Boot Hill Blades, just put up a pile of knives all using the Hoopla, a variation of the Hoopla, I think. I mean, you can't get much better. I mean, if Jared Thatcher's using it, I mean, you can't get much better than him. He's my guy. I use it. Everybody uses it. This stuff is awesome. So definitely get yourself involved with that. GL Hansen & Sons, G.L._Hansen & Sons on Instagram. Go follow it up because your customers are going to start asking. You better find out about it because some customers are going to say, hey, listen, I want a knife from you, but I need to use that, I need to use that Hoopla. You better figure out what it is. You better check it out. You better get yourself some because customers are starting to ask for it. Next are my friends at Tormek, Tormek_sharpening Instagram, Tormek.com. They're the best. It has changed the way I make knives. It's a water-cooled sharpening system that allows you to sharpen carefully and quickly and succinctly and efficiently without taking there's no heat on your blade. You're not taking too much material off. It's very gradual. They hold your hand until you're ready to not have your hand held. This stuff is awesome. I'm a huge fan. And my guys at Tormek are great. And I know my man Carl Friends, who comes on the podcast every so often. And trust me, it's because I love them. This is not an obligation. I love the guys at Tormek. And anytime they want to come on, they're just great guys. And they're great guys representing a great company. So definitely check out Tormek. _sharpening Instagram, and if you have any questions for them, their customer service is awesome, and you're gonna be talking to someone in Sweden. Ladies and gentlemen, the customer service is in Sweden, and they're fantastic. Definitely check out them. Now, if you're in Australia, you got to go to NordicEdge.com.au. Nordic Edge is about the joy of making something with your own hands. They sell knife making supplies, blacksmithing supplies, but they also teach. This is important. So when you're listening to this and you're thinking about all the equipment you want to buy, it would be great to be able to take a class. And if you are in Australia, you can go to nordicedge.com.au, and then that's where you can learn about their blacksmithing classes, knife making classes, spoon carving classes, leatherworking. Sausage Man Forge is involved. If that's good enough for you, it's good enough for me. Bjorn, they're great. They're a great company, and they not only do they have one of the best file guides in the biz, that you also, P.S., you can get the Nordic Edge file guide at Maritime Knife Supply, but they're great. They're great guys, and I believe in what they're doing. So nordicedge.com.au. They have the guidance to help accelerate your creativity and the tools, products, and supplies to help you manifest your ideas. Nordic Edge. And last but certainly not least, I want to thank my friends at Phoenix Abrasives. It's phoenixabrasives.com. Phoenix Abrasives suppliers are superior abrasive products for every application: knife making, metal fabrication, glass fabrication, floor sanding, and crankshaft. That's right, ladies and gentlemen, crankshaft. So get all your belts, your grinding, and your cutting disc, flap disc, surface belt, all that stuff for surface conditioning. at Phoenix Abrasives. I get a lot of belts from them, and I go on their website every so often, and they're very good about allowing you to buy the way you want to buy. Some of these big guys won't let you buy it the way you want to buy, and they can buy it. You can buy it one or 10 or whatever you want, and then you have a lot of options. And the other thing is if you go to checkout, you can put in the promo code FB10, and you're going to get 10% off the whole website, which is great. Many thanks to my friends at Phoenix Abrasives, and many thanks to all my sponsors. And many thanks to my man Jaden Schubert's here, Fox River Blades. This is a really, really, I've been looking forward to this episode for a long time. Jaden is a knife maker of Fox River Blades. He makes beautiful knives. I've known him since he was very on the younger side. He was a listener of Knife Talk, and he's got an incredible story of fortitude. And we're going to get into it. Jaden, how the hell are you?
I'm doing good. I got to say, we've been talking about doing this for a while, and I started to think I was getting let on like I was back in high school. So I'm happy to be here, though.
Listen, I appreciate you saying that, and I apologize. Now, here's the thing. In my mind, when I say this to people, a lot of times, time is on your side because it gives me the opportunity to kind of figure out what we're going to talk about, too. So I always, you know, you've been, once again, your story is one of the more incredible stories of inner fortitude. And like I said, I met you. You were listening to Knife Talk a number of years ago. Yep. Well, let's just get into it. How did you get into knife making?
So I got into knife making originally. So I grew up, first I was really, like when I was younger, I was really into art. And then I got into making stuff. I have a friend named Alec, and we grew up making like different weapons and contraptions and stuff like that, like potato gun or potato launchers and stuff like that. And then I saw a video on Facebook of a guy, like one of those time-lapse videos of a guy forging a knife out of a wrench.
Yeah.
And I was working at Subway at the time. I was technically, it was illegal for me to be working there because I was 15. And but I was working there at the time, and I saved up some money, and I bought an angle grinder and a Dremel tool, and then I just kind of started. I found some scrap metal at my grandma's farm, and then started cutting and grinding away.
Question for you: what made you get a job at 15?
I wanted. Growing up, I was pretty middle class. I didn't have like an allowance or anything. Lower middle class, I would say. My mom worked at Cost Cutters, and so like I grew up very comfortable. She always made sure we were well taken care of, but we didn't have a ton of extra money to get stuff. And there was stuff that like any teenage kid wants. I wanted stuff. And so I had to go out and get my own.
And nobody kind of said to you, there was no sit down moment where they said, Jaden, I know you want all this stuff and we can't provide all the time. You got to go get yourself a job. Cause that's something that usually like a parent will say. Where they'll explain to a kid, look, you know, if you want a little bit extra money, you got to work for it. And some kids, they don't really see the fact that they just kind of want stuff without understanding that I got to go to work.
Yeah, my mom never like sat down and talked to me. It was just kind of something I understood.
That's amazing. I mean, that's self-motivating is at an early age is one of those things that, you know, it's not easy.
Yeah, I don't know exactly where it came from. It was just kind of over time being raised by her and stuff like that. She kind of put values in me, set, like with kind of independence and stuff like that.
I one thing I do notice is, you know, my daughter's about to turn 21, and we had a lot of conversations. She worked as a young person without us really kind of like, you know, suggesting it. And one of the things I've noticed is that especially with like, you know, being a parent and kids, is it's never telling someone to do something. It's always showing them. So I would imagine that you saw your mom go to work all the time and you saw how hard she worked. And that was kind of more along the lines of more influential than just being told, all right, Jaden, you want to get all this equipment, you better get a job. And you're just like, oh, geez, mom, I don't want to get a job. You know, obviously you saw that kind of hardworking mentality at a young age.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. She was the definition of making it happen. Like she was a single mom raising three kids, and working, I mean, cost cutters, working at cost cutters, you don't make a ton of money, but she always made sure we had good clothes, good food, all that stuff. So yeah, she's the definition of making it happen.
Shout out to mom. Jeez. That is one of the hardest things, us being a single parent, is in trying to, you know, make it happen with three kids. It must have been kind of hard.
Yeah, for sure. But I couldn't ask for a better childhood than what I had.
Oh, fantastic. Fantastic. And you liked school, or you didn't like school?
I always liked the social parts of school. I made it clear all throughout high school and stuff like that. Whenever we would have the meetings with the counselors talking about college and stuff, I would always make it clear college is not in the picture for me. I'm going to do what I have to do to pass, but that's about it.
What were your thoughts in regards to when you're in school of what you wanted to do?
When I was younger, when I was like really young, I wanted to be a vet. And then once I got interested in making stuff, I had thought about doing like being a robotics engineer, but I'm a terrible math student and there's a lot of math in that. So that was out of the picture. And then, late middle school, early high school, I started really knife making, and that was kind of my path.
And I would imagine, especially in high school and you're making knives, I'm sure your friends and people are starting to take notice. Do you remember the first knife you made that you sold?
Yeah, it was a little like woodworking kiridashi. So like it's just a single bevel Japanese woodworking knife. And that was the first knife I sold. I had made a bunch of knives or a handful of knives before then, but they were just god-awful. So I didn't sell them and I didn't really show anybody. But the first knife that I actually sold, I brought it over to show my friend Alec that I was talking about earlier. And he was like, you should show my dad. And his dad is the owner of a very successful kind of EDC product business.
Huh.
And he was like, you should make an Instagram, because he made a lot of money through Instagram kind of in the earlier days of like making stuff on Instagram. And he said, you should make an Instagram post. And I was very self-conscious about it because my knives look terrible. And kind of whenever you're a kid and you're talking about, oh, I make knives, people think you're like scraping them on a concrete floor in prison, like making prison shanks. And so I was like, well, I don't know about that. But he convinced me, and he had a friend who does woodworking, and so he messaged him and was like, hey, my son's friend has this knife that he made. Would you want to buy it? And so that night I made $80.
How good did you feel?
It was kind of the first time I'd ever thought about possibly actually pursuing knife making as more than just like a hobby. And I started to actually think about like how I could turn it into a career.
Because you're also thinking about how much that knife, you enjoyed every second of making it compared to how many shifts at Subway gets you $80.
Oh, dear God. Yeah.
Seriously.
Yeah, for sure. Like I to this day, I still love just about every bit of making the knife. And so it's very fulfilling to do all this work and then have the at that time it was a big payout at the end.
I think about this all the time because of the questions that we get on Knife Talk and here, and talking to a lot of younger people and talking to a lot of artists and makers and people who make knives and people make tools. And there's a difference between people who make art and people who make knives. And one of the differences is when you learn how to make a knife, you're making something that you think is nice. And then when somebody else thinks it's nice and they want to buy it, and then they use it for their own day-to-day, whatever it is, depending on whatever it is almost a little bit more, it's a little bit more satisfying, because it's not just as something you hang on the wall that you look at, but especially if you're using it and you're getting good use out of it and creating memories with it or nurturing people with a culinary knife or something like that, there's more value to it. And I feel as though it almost makes the maker just feeling better about themselves.
Yeah. I mean, like with a lot of art, especially if like with paintings and stuff like that, you kind of hang them up in your house and eventually they kind of blend into the background.
Right.
But with knives, you're all like, there's, I get a very good feeling when I get a message or someone tells me like, hey, I just use your knife to skin a deer or whatever. I can't believe this thing.
So that's amazing.
Yeah.
So you're now, at what point are you just like, I don't have to, now are you 15 when you start making knives or?
Yeah, I started making them when I was 15.
All right. So when did you give in your Subway slip? When did you make the decision? Did you talk to your mom saying, look, I don't need this. I'm sure she's thinking, you don't need to work anyway. You're 15. But when do you decide I'm going to quit Subway because I'm going to make knives full time?
So I quit Subway.
Whatever time.
Yeah, I quit Subway. And then I started pretty much right afterwards. I had pretty much had a job lined up where I was going to be working at a local diner pub type thing. Huh. And so I did pretty much every job there except for like I was a prep cook for a summer. So chopping up onions and peeling potatoes and stuff like that. I was a delivery driver. I was a a server, host. So I did pretty much every job there.
And then when did you decide I don't need to do any of this anymore? I'm just going to make knives.
So that wasn't actually until after my car accident. Even before my car accident, I was working as a CNC machinist operator at a machine shop, kind of the next city over from me.
How did you get that job?
The guy who told me, Rich, who told me to make my Instagram page, he owned it with two of his siblings, and so it was originally started by their father, and then once he retired they kind of got it split ownership of it. And I was always really close with that family. Like, I used to go to church with them and everything. I'd hang out at their house all the time, and so I had connections. It wasn't quite nepotism, but it was almost there.
All right, whatever it takes. That's what networking is.
Yep.
And you're in Wisconsin? Yeah.
Yep.
Where in Wisconsin?
Central. So about kind of like right smack dab in between Green Bay and Milwaukee, an hour and a half away from each.
Oh, I have family in Madison, so I'm there at least once a year.
Oh, I got you. Have you heard of Oshkosh B'gosh?
Yeah, the pants.
Yes. I live 30 minutes away from Oshkosh, which is where I worked for the machine shop.
Oh, famous for their overalls.
Yep.
Famous for their overalls and their train hats.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had a pair of Oshkosh B'gosh when I was a kid. Amazing. So I was looking at your website, and I know that, are you still, while you're working at the CNC shop, you're still making knives on the side, or?
Yeah, while I was working there, I would go to school. I would wake up, go to school until like pretty much lunchtime, and then I would leave. I had a work leave for the second half of the day, pretty much. And then I would go work at the CNC machine shop for 8 hours and then go back to my shop and work until midnight, 1 a.m, and then go home, shower, and then restart.
Wow. Do you think when you were working at the CNC shop, did you pick up any tricks that you thought you could use for knife making? Like just even the smallest little details?
I mean, I did a lot of work on like the lapping machine and also like deburring and stuff like that. So it wasn't anything like crazy, but there were small things like kind of precision measurements and stuff like that that I learned how to use properly and stuff like that.
Do you think that it changed the way you made knives?
It thought about, they have, for all the parts, they have like a kind of a process sheet that goes over each process and all that stuff. So I've thought about actually turning it into more of a system as opposed to like what do I do next type thing.
Yeah. So it's more organization.
Yeah, for sure.
I think that people, especially young knife makers, don't realize that anything, any job that you have can help you in the knife making. And I know that all the jobs I've ever had helped me. The first job I ever had was I was picking up dog shit on the streets of Manhattan. And it was, I didn't have a boss. I didn't have anybody who to tell me whether I could do it or not. I would just go every once a week, and then I would clean up the streets of this particular streets from Lexington Avenue to Fifth Avenue. I'd pick up the dog, you know, poo and the pits and stuff like that. And then I submitted a bill. But there was nobody saying, you got to get out there. It was a degree of self-motivation. And I know that that definitely helped me in regards to self-motivation. So I'm just imagining that almost anything that you, any job that you were doing kind of helped influence you with Fox River Blades.
Yeah, for sure. The, like I said, the machine shop was a good in terms of actually seeing how production works and everything, because we would make parts for John Deere, and there's a military, they're contracted by the military, that's called Oshkosh Truck, and they make, and so we would make parts for them, but it was all like systematic and very big batches of parts and stuff like that.
Now, I was looking at your website, and you're very honest, and you're very forthcoming in regards to your life and what's happened, and we're going to get to a lot of that. But you did talk a lot about your dad. Do you want to talk about your dad at all, or?
Yeah, for sure. Whatever you want to know.
Well, I mean, tell me about your young childhood with him.
Yeah, so I kind of, growing up, he struggled with a lot of addiction and stuff like that. He had a rough upbringing, and kind of when I didn't know about all this, spoiler, he passed away when I was in middle school. But
I've never heard someone spoiler alert the death of their own father. It's unbelievable. I got to do that too. I'm going to do that someday too.
There
go
you
ahead.
Go.
I don't mean to make jokes, but at the same time, gallows humor sometimes works.
Yep. And growing up, he pretty much all of my life, he worked in a kitchen. And so I learned a lot of cooking from him, and I always knew like my mom would be like, well, he's sick and he went away. He would be going later. I would find out to rehab and stuff like that. And so he was always trying to get better, but never seemed to be able to completely overcome it. But something that I later appreciated kind of after learning how some people's stories can go is sometimes the parents will bring that, all of that negative energy into their household. And it was like, he kind of lived like a double life. Like at home, he was like the best dad ever. Pretty much anyone who knows him knows how kind he was and everything like that. But he just had this, these demons that he couldn't shake. But, yeah, in terms of being at home and stuff like that, he was very kind. He had OCD, and so he was always like cleaning and stuff. He was a very good cook. He worked at some like fancy steakhouses and stuff. Never like five-star stuff, but he was definitely worked at some nice steakhouses and some Italian restaurants and stuff like that. And so he was a very positive role model for me when he was there. And then when I was in third grade, my mom picked me up from school one day and told me that he had gotten arrested, and he spent 4 years in prison due to some drug possession stuff. And then but I would always we always went and visited him. We would play like Scrabble, and so I got pretty good at Scrabble, and chess we would play a lot and stuff like that. And he always wrote letters, and I have a giant stack of letters still. And he would draw. He was a very good artist, and so he would make these drawings of animals, because I was really into animals at the time. And so he would send these pictures that he would draw with pens, and he would do like the pens were expensive in prison, I guess, and so he would do like the crosshatch shading and stuff like that. Yeah. To preserve the ink. And so it was I'm very grateful for him and everything like that.
That's really remarkable and very generous on his part. He probably was incredibly proud of you. And the fact that he was able to, you know, compartmentalize, you know, his addiction to not affect the upbringing of his children is a generous act.
Yeah.
you know? Mm-hmm. It's not easy. I mean, my I have family members who have major addiction and some who've passed away. And I know that there was a lot of bringing that home and in a not a positive way. And all I can say is it's generous of him to, you know, be very, very well aware of what he was, you know, fighting his demons, but also figuring out ways in which to, you know, raise a child. And it's a very brave and generous is the only thing I can think of.
Yeah, he was pretty remarkable in that sense. I'd had no idea about any of his addictions or anything like that until after he had passed. So,
and your mom is like a saint.
Yeah,
your mom is like, you know, doing whatever it takes to keep you and your siblings squared away, and that couldn't have been easy.
No, for sure. Some of the stories that she's told me, like, is like, in terms of like people that were his drug dealers, like threatening her and stuff, like threatening her and the kids and us and stuff like that.
Whoa.
And she like fucking gave him the business. So it was,
wow.
Yeah.
Mama Bear. Don't fuck with Mama Bear. That's exactly. Unbelievable. Respect to Mom. I hope she doesn't listen to that part where I said that, but hey, listen, Mrs. Schubert, you did it. Yeah. I mean, you raised this kid is unbelievable. And did your dad ever get to see any of your work? Your knives?
Very, very early on. Very early on. So, yeah, it was kind of... I'm trying to think. It might not have been... I was making stuff at the time, but I don't know if I was making knives at the time. Because I started making stuff, like random stuff, kind of early and middle school. Huh. But I didn't actually start seriously making knives until kind of late middle school. So I'm not... I'm sorry, what's that?
Go ahead. No, go ahead. I interrupted you. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say that we would go to the flea market in his town, and that's where I started collecting knives. Just like kind of shitty gas station type knives and stuff like that. And then... So he was there for my... Where I started becoming interested in knives, but I don't know if he was there when I started actually seriously making them.
That's the one thing that when my father died, spoiler alert, my dad died too. when I think about him, he knew me up until right before I started knife making. Mm. And when I was working at the Center for Metal Arts as a fabricator and as a teacher, he referred to me as, in a very derogatory way. He would say, "Oh, my son, the welder." You know, as in like there was, you know, that I could have done anything else. And I do really kind of think about the fact that I wish he had gotten to see where I've gotten to. And I would think you the same way. I mean, this isn't a story of like a guy making knives. I mean, what Jaden is, the knives that he produced have been, I mean, they're beautiful. They're amazing. And we're going to talk about that in a minute. But that is one thing that I think that I kind of wish my father had gotten to see.
I agree. I would like to be able to kind of show him where I've gotten and then also have some interesting conversations that I didn't get to have just because, I mean, when you're a teenager, you don't really think about or want to talk to your parents. It's quite the opposite, to be honest.
Right.
You're just wanting to do your own thing. So that's something I wish I could do.
Yeah, because you're proud of what you're doing. You put the time in. You put the energy in. You put the, you know, it's hot. This is the one thing that a lot of people who want to get into knife making don't realize is that it takes a long time to like get proficient to the point. And once you get proficient, there are people who have passed away that you're just like, boy, I wish they could see me now.
Yeah.
And that's that. I'm in the same boat. Like I think about my father who was a great cook. And I think about the fact that I really wish you could have seen these now or even we could collaborate on something. And so I definitely feel for what you're going through in that regards.
Yeah.
So when he passed away, I mean, that was, you know, obviously, you know, people grieve in different ways. And obviously you had a very close relationship to him. I would imagine that the knife making was very therapeutic for you.
Yeah, it was a lot of that was a lot of my free time. Like any time that I was free from school and stuff like that, I was normally kind of in my shop. And that was a big coping mechanism for me.
And how old are you now?
Right now? I'm 22.
Yeah, so you've been listening. I mean, you've been a Knife Talk listener for a long time. Like I remember because I do all the for all the knife talk questions, I always kind of go through and I always remember the names. And I remember a number of years ago, you were sending in messages, and I always thought that the questions that you were asked were very thoughtful and good questions. I always felt that your presence was very positive, but also very intelligent.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I had genuine questions, but I didn't want to ask like the what's your grip progression type questions, because
That's a deep cut. That's a deep cut right there.
Those horses have been beat for a while now. But
well, listen, I'm the sole editor of the questions. Your name I always saw you as one of the real, you know, hardcore guys who were listening every week and submitting your questions. And I felt like I knew you, and you're a great kid, and you're really, really, really smart. And I just remember that you were in a horrendous, horrendous car accident.
Yeah.
Can you set that story up on what happened and what was the precursor for the...
Yeah, so I was kind of, while I was working at, I was starting to get some serious burnout working at, this is when I was working at the machine shop and going to school, and then coming home and working in the shop, and I was just doing that loop over and over again. I was getting pretty burnt out, and my family, it was kind of like a perfect storm of everybody was going to be in Florida at once. My sister is a physician's assistant, and so she was doing a rotation down in Florida, and then my brother is a semi-pro motocross racer.
Wow.
And he was going to be like, you know, where they race the Daytona 500 and stuff like that. In the off season, they had like a motocross race in that arena and stuff like that. It wasn't as big as the Daytona 500, but there was quite a bit of people there. And so we were all going to be down there, and I wasn't going to go on the trip originally, just because I was focused on work and stuff like that. But then I was going through a kind of a rocky breakup at the time, like as any teenage man has went through. And I was like, fuck it, I got to get out of here for a little while, just kind of come back and reset. And then on our way back, it was about 4 a.m, and we were all asleep. I was kind of half dozing in and out of sleep, listening to a podcast. And then I felt some rumbling, and then I kind of heard my grandpa say like, oh shit. And so it was my grandpa driving, my grandma in the passenger seat, and then my mom in the middle left seat, my mom in the middle left seat, my brother-in-law in the middle right seat, and then I was in the far back and in the back left, and then my little brother was in the back right. And I thought I heard my grandpa say like, oh shit, or something like that, felt some rumbling. And then we went off the road, hit a culvert, and then rolled 6 times up a hill.
Oh my God.
And I was kind of laying across the back of the bench seat. My legs were kind of propped up on my little brother's legs, and we rolled. It was very chaotic, and then it went dead silent. Luckily, we landed right side up. But I thought my legs were trapped under, like trapped in the seat. And so I told my little brother, once everything settled, I told my little brother to see if he can get my legs unstuck. And he couldn't lift them. And he started panicking a little bit, because he was, I want to say 7 or 8 at the time.
Oh my God.
And so he was like, we're going to die and stuff like that. And I was like, no, it's okay, it's okay. And he was, do you know the country singer Merle Haggard?
Or have sure.
you
heard?
Yeah, so I started, he was really, I showed him the song Mama Tried by Merle Haggard, and so I started singing that to him to calm him down. And he was still in a lot of pain, obviously, and I can go through everyone's injuries. Spoiler alert, nobody died this time.
And oh, then, good. And then, I'm sorry for laughing, but I mean, come on, that's, all right, no, I'm sorry for laughing.
No, go ahead.
Go ahead.
But, and then, so I tried sitting up, and as you can imagine, my back was pretty hurt. And so I was like, oh, I can't do that. And then I laid back, the EMT got here, and he talked through the back window. And at this time, it was getting kind of harder for me to breathe. And he's like, what's going on? Or is everyone okay back here? And what's your guys' names? And I was starting to not be able to talk. And my little brother was like, my name's Jackson. My brother's Jade. And he was like, all right, well, we're going to get you guys out of here, okay? And so then after the crash, the door of the right side door fell open. So my brother-in-law got out. And then my mom crawled out after him. And they were the most concerned at the time about my grandpa because he was on blood thinners. And his face was cut open. He was bleeding pretty bad and stuff like that. And then... so once they got out, they took out the seats and put me on a stretcher, and then once I, obviously they were back at the accident still, and they took me in the ambulance, and they were like, can you feel this? Can you try to wiggle your toes? And then I kind of started to realize, like, oh, shit. The reason why my brother couldn't get my legs unpinned is because I couldn't move them. They were I was paralyzed, obviously, and... that started to set in to me once they were asking me those questions. I was like, am I paralyzed? And they're like, well, we're not sure yet, and we got to get back to the hospital and do some more testing. And then once we got there, they had to cut a chest tube in my side. And my older brother had arrived at the time, and he was driving like a big sprinter van. Oh, I got a fucking guy driving past my house.
Don't worry about it. Don't worry about that. Don't worry about that.
But, my brother had gotten there, and he, you know, like the clearance bars on parking lots and stuff like that, that say like 10-foot clearance and they're hanging down?
Yeah.
Well, my brother, he had a roof mount, and he crashed through one of those to get into the hospital. And so while he was getting there, I was getting my chest tube cut open. They were like, all right, we're going to roll you on your side, and this is going to sting a little bit. And then I remember the burning of when they cut the chest tube open in my side. And then pretty much my grandpa broke his eye socket and his cheekbone on one side of his face. My grandma broke her sternum and some ribs. My brother-in-law sprained both ankles and both wrists. And then my mom broke her scapula really bad. And a couple other things that I can't think of, some vertebrae on her back. And then my little brother had broke his femur, 100% displaced. He broke a couple of vertebrae. He had a lacerated liver from the seat belt and stuff like that. And then I broke my back. I had a collapsed lung, a hemopneumothorax on one side, and a pneumothorax on the other. So one lung was collapsed or punctured and filling up with blood, and then the other one was just collapsed, which explains the reason why I couldn't really talk and breathe that well.
Oh, my God.
I had 6 broken ribs on one side and 1 broken rib on the other that was the one that punctured my lung, and then, which later had to get removed during surgery. I broke my sternum. I had a minor brain bleed, a concussion, and... I think that's it.
I'm amazed that you were conscious for all this.
Yeah.
You think that with the shock and all of it, you would have been like, you know, wake up and you're in the hospital room. You're very conscious for all of it. And it must have been incredibly traumatic also seeing your whole family all in this horrendous car accident, and everyone's bloody and upset, and your brother's upset. And it must have been like the worst trauma you can imagine.
Yeah, it was pretty tough. I, like, to this day, I can't really sleep in cars anymore and stuff like that. Like, I'm a terrible, terrible passenger just because I'm always like, oh, shit, whenever we're on the highway and stuff like that.
Of course.
But I remember it very well. My mom doesn't. I don't know about anyone else. But, yeah, my mom doesn't remember any of it. But it's pretty vivid in my memory.
And do you know what happened with your grandfather? I mean, it's early in the morning.
Yeah, so we were all falling asleep, and he also just kind of dozed off. We were about 30 to 40 minutes away before we were going to switch drivers. And he just kind of dozed off along with everyone else.
And he must feel terrible.
Yeah, I I know he for surely did a lot, and he dealt with a lot of guilt and grief and stuff like that. I just, at least for my end, I always made sure that he never felt like responsible or never wanted him to feel bad or anything for it. It could have happened to anyone.
You're a good dude. That's a once again, probably comes a little bit from your dad. That's a generous thing.
I don't know how long I'm going to get left with them, and I just don't want that to be something that is eating him alive or anything like that. Yeah.
Oh, no, you're a very, very generous guy. And I'm sure it comes from your upbringing and your religion and all your upbringing, really. I think it's a testament to the kind of person that you are.
Now, I appreciate that.
I remember when you first started posting, because this is, you think about what social media is for, and you think about it like, for me, I see social media strictly for business. I send some, put some pictures up of my family once in a while, but generally speaking, to me, it's like completely to move the needle in regards to Fader Knives. And I'm thinking to myself, I remember seeing your posts, and I wouldn't have known if you hadn't posted, that you had been in this terrible, you're posting video from the hospital bed. And I was like, what happened to Fox River? And you were very, like, it was in the beginning, you were very candid. I was in this terrible accident. I don't know the extent of what's going on. And they were riveting because you were very, like, matter of fact, and here's what happened.
Yeah, I wasn't, part of that also came just because I was on a lot of drugs at the time. And so I wasn't completely, like, thought out about what I was talking about. But
did you, it was compelling. You must have had a lot of people like reach out and wondering if you're okay.
Yeah. When I woke up, I had wasn't quite graduated high school, but I was just about there. Like I was done. I graduated early, but high school was still going on. And so I don't know exactly what all happened at my high school, but things got around pretty quick. And a lot of people reached out to me. My ex-girlfriend, the first thing that she said, she messaged me. Or apparently, I gotten a call from a friend of mine that was a friend of hers. And the first thing that she asked me if my dick still worked. And I was like, well, I don't know, but I'll get back to you on that. So I was like, it was quite shocking to see that was the first thing that
that's
she thought
the of. Fucking first, that's no wonder she's ex. Yep. That's the first thing you ask? Hilarious. Comedy is tragedy plus time. So now you can look back on it as a great story. But at the first time, if I was sitting in the hospital bed high as a kite, and I get a message from my ex-girlfriend saying, does your dick still work? I don't know how I would have taken it.
Yeah, I was just like, I'll let you know. I have no idea. But, I forgot your question now.
I was just saying that I would think that once you started posting that you a lot of people probably reached out to see how you're doing, either in school or in the knife making community, because you created quite a nice little community of other knife makers and stuff.
Yeah, I was in a group chat with a bunch of knife makers. I still am. And a guy that I had gotten pretty friendly with named Chumney Knives, Jordan Chumney, he organized along with a bunch of other knife makers, like this charity raffle type thing. And they raised quite a bit of money for me. I don't know if I should say the amount, but it was a good sum of money. And I was like, actually blown away at the support that I had gotten the amount of messages and everything like that was kind of crazy.
At what point do they tell you the extent of the damage? I would imagine it takes a few days and lots of testing for them to tell you that you officially your legs are paralyzed.
Yeah.
Or you're paralyzed.
Yeah. They came in and the first couple days were fuzzy and stuff like that. I got an emergency surgery pretty much the day that I got in there. And then once I was out of it, or out of surgery and kind of sobering back up slightly, they kind of came in and said, like, we think that we're not sure how much return you'll get, but as you sit now, you're paralyzed from T7, which is kind of just below your nipple line. So like you're just below the bottom of your sternum down. So like my abdominals and all that and below, you're paralyzed. And so there was like some possibilities of that. It was other things that were like temporary, but they're like, we're pretty sure that this is the extent of it. And it's more permanent than you would like.
And what are you thinking at this time?
I couldn't, in the first probably week, I didn't really have many thoughts of it. They had me on like, morphine on the button. So I was, chance I got of that, I didn't know it, but it was on a timer. So I was just sitting clicking the
Morse
button.
Code?
Yeah.
You weren't sending a long Morse code message?
No. And so to my disappointment, but so that first week was kind of just trying to like actually get through like the worst of it, and then kind of the second and third week that I was in the hospital, I started to kind of ask more questions and kind of figure out the extent of everything, and I had to learn how to like sit up, and that was terrible. And they kind of mold a turtle shell on you, like a plastic turtle shell, to help stabilize your back. And they had given me, they switched me off of morphine and gave me Oxycontin, which makes me really nauseous. And so all that happened the same day. Oh. And I was just like I was super nauseous, because when you're bedridden for a week straight, your blood pressure gets really wonky once you sit back up. And so I didn't really think a lot about it until pretty much I was out of the hospital. I just wanted to get home at that point, because I started to go a little bit stir crazy in the hospital. I knew at home at least I could kind of be comfortable where I was and stuff like that. But
now, what, I mean, how, you were in the hospital for quite a long time, right?
Yeah, it was like three-ish weeks of,
wow.
And then I went home and had a lot of outpatient therapy and stuff like that.
So you're out of the hospital, you're thinking everything's going to be better, and then all of a sudden you realize my life has changed.
Yeah. You know,
even the simplest things now, my life has changed. What are some of the things that when you got home you didn't realize were going to be a problem? Or more difficult to you?
Yeah, so when I got home, I'd learned this in the hospital, but it didn't really set in until I got home. Pretty much after my accident, my family back home like completely restructured the house to where they completely redid the bathroom to make it a walk-in shower. I had moved out at the time, so at the time when I was working at the CNC shop and everything, I had moved into an apartment that my uncle had available, and so it was a duplex, and so I was living there, and then I was like, oh, I got this freedom. And then right about probably three months after I moved in there, I got in my accident. I was like, shit, so now I'm back at my mom's house. And then, so yeah, stuff like bathing, getting in the shower and stuff like that. Transferring is just what they call pretty much moving from your wheelchair to another seat. So like transferring in and out of cars, getting dressed was a pain. It was really hard to put on jeans, but in the hospital, I told my mom I wasn't going to be one of those wheelchair people that only wear sweatpants and Velcro shoes. So I learned how to put on jeans and I got special boots and stuff like that that can zip. They have zippers down the side that are for handicapped people. I got getting dressed, bathing and stuff like that. Even stuff like getting out of bed. There's pretty much a piece of wood called a slide board that I had to use originally, because my body wasn't strong enough to. Now I can kind of just muscle myself with my arms, but back then I couldn't really do that. My back wasn't stable enough to where I could kind of swing around and take a little bit of impact. And so just stuff like that. I those first couple months, I spent a lot of time just kind of in my bed. I couldn't sit up for more than 2 hours at a time.
So, you know, obviously you're coming to grips with the fact that your life has now dramatically changed. Mm-hmm. How, in your mindset, what do you, I mean, obviously you already told your mom, I'm going to, you know, you're already very positive, even, you know, making jokes about the fact you're not going to be sweatpants and Velcro shoes. That's even a joke. That's even like very positive and reassuring that you're just like, you're already thinking forward to like, you know, in a positive manner.
Yeah.
At what point are you thinking to yourself, what am I going to do now?
Yeah, so backing up, responding to your first part about positivity, I tried right away, I tried making sure kind of everyone in my family knew that I was okay. I hate getting pictures taken of me. And so it used to be a family thing that anytime someone would try to take a picture of me, I'd flip off the camera so they wouldn't be able to post it.
That's funny.
And so I had gotten a little bit of a reputation in my family for doing that. And then when the first time my mom saw me after the car accident, you might have seen the picture at some point. I said, "Hey mom, take a picture of this." And I flipped her off, and she says that was the second that she knew like everything was going to be, we were going to get through it. And so then could you reiterate your question?
Well, I mean, you're finally coming to the real grips of the fact that you're now in this position where life is going to be harder. At what point are you thinking, well, what am I going to do now?
Yeah.
Or are you immediately thinking, I'm going to make knives no matter what?
Yeah, so that was wanting to still make knives was something that I had gotten in my head that I wanted to do when I was still in the hospital. I was trying to figure out ways in which we could make it happen and everything like that. Once I got to where I could actually be up for a little bit of time and stuff like that, my first thing that we did is we cleaned out my mom's part of my mom's garage, and we brought my shop to her garage. They cut down my workbenches like 4 or 5 inches just so that they were a little bit lower, so all my grinders and stuff were at the right height. And so that was like my first big milestone for me, was getting back out in the shop. And at first it was just, there were all these projects that I had from before the accident that I was just kind of getting back into it and slowly working at it and everything. And then after that, I didn't want to live in my mom's house. I moved out because I wanted to kind of be on my own and have my own space. And so after I had started working out in my shop again while doing physical therapy, my next thought was like, how am I going to be able to, what do I have to do to be able to live on my own again? And one of the first things for me was after getting in the shop was learning how to drive again. And so we asked my physical therapist and we did some research online and stuff, and we got hand controls for the car that I had, that my mom had at the time. And it's pretty much, it's just like two bars connected to the brake and gas pedal. And then you press your thumb for gas and you press your palm for brakes. And so we went into a school park, me and my stepdad went into a school parking lot and kind of messed around with that for a little bit, trying to get used to it. And that was a big milestone. So then I could actually leave the house by myself. I had to stay in my car if I was by myself, but we used to go down to this parking lot and hang out with my friends and stuff like that. So I was able to actually go down there by them and stuff, which was a big mental boost, because
I bet
being kind of stuck in your room or stuck in your house and everything was quite difficult. And then
Your friends were happy to see you.
Yeah, they were very, because I didn't tell anybody that I learned how to drive. And so when I pulled up, people were like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
And so,
but they were psyched.
Yeah, it was awesome. It was a great feeling mentally. And it was a huge, kind of the more good things happened, the more I wanted to do more. And so obviously, as you can imagine, I was dealing with, like, mentally, it was still difficult. Like, I no matter how hard you try to be positive, it was still very difficult. And I had a lot of times where I wanted to say, like, fuck this. But my mom, like, for instance, like, if I didn't want to get out of bed and go into the take a shower or something like that, my mom would be like, you're not going to be one of those smelly ass crippled people. Pretty much. I mean, she didn't say that. I'm sure putting words in her mouth, don't worry,
we have nothing. Your mother is as sad as her hit sainthood. Don't worry about that.
And so she was like, anytime that I wanted to slow down or stop, either her or my sister would give me a kick in the ass, a much needed one, but at the time I didn't want it. But that was kind of the next steps.
What's amazing is you know, I would think, this is based off of how I would think you get home and you're just like, well, how am I going to get in the shop? And now not only how am I going to get in the shop, but now the way I work is going to be different, because not only is everything lower, but my legs are now ahead of me. My legs and my knees are ahead of me. So now I have to change the way my grinders. I saw this amazing picture, which is probably going to be the picture of this episode. You're so smart. You put a big pan on your lap, so when you're grinding blades, the sparks lands in the pan on your lap.
Yep.
How do you figure this stuff out? I'm thinking to myself, I'm looking at my shop now, and I know that, like, how am I going to get around the weird parts of the shop in a wheelchair? Because it's now all of a sudden it's much wider than just walking past something. You know, yeah. How are you figuring out how to kind of get your life back together in the shop?
Yeah. So the first thing was making sure the benches were all good, because for me at the time, the most important thing was making sure I could grind comfortably at a similar level to what I was. And then organizing my shop, kind of making things more spread out and wide, was a big thing. Having tables that I could actually go under instead of, because like sometimes the bracing would get in the way, or like right on the bottom. So we cut those out of any benches, so that I would just have it on the backside where I wouldn't reach. And then, yeah, it's a metal garbage lid, and I don't know exactly where it happened. I think at the beginning it first started, and I was like, well, this can't work because I'm going to start my pants on fire. And so I was looking around in the garage, and I saw this metal garbage lid that of my stepdad's, and I was like, hey, could I use this? And he said, yep. And I started using that, but then I later found out that it turns out when you're grinding really hard and all the heat builds up on top of the pan, I ended up getting first-degree burns on my thigh because the heat from the pan, or the heat from the grinding, went through the garbage lid.
And you couldn't feel it.
And I couldn't feel it. And so when I went to change, I had this giant blister on my thigh that's probably the size of like a tennis ball. And so then I iterated and started putting I folded up a towel and put it on my lap before. Now I put it on my lap before I put the pan on when I grind.
Isn't that unbelievable? When you're grinding a knife, you usually grind without gloves on because you want to make sure that your finger can feel how hot it is before you ruin your temper.
Yeah.
But this is in this strange irony. You can't tell. Well, your legs, you can't tell that your legs are burning because you have no feeling. It's just like this, you know, crazy cosmic irony.
Yeah, it was something that I'd never thought of that would have been a possibility, but it became very real.
Did you find that now you got your shop squared away, you have this incredible support system? I mean, your family is unbelievable, and your friends are, it's got to be very, you don't feel like you're alone. And you have they're helping you. Your stepfather's helping you. Everybody's helping you get your life back together. Are you feeling invigorated with the way Fox River Knives is going to start? When do you decide to get the new website and then just kind of go into it, you know, both, you know, forward?
So one of the kind of ironic things that happened after I got my car accident is that I started getting disability. I still continue to get disability. Turns out that once you get on it, it's actually extremely difficult to get off without, because they'll try to make you pay back all the money that they sent you. And so I got on disability, which allowed me to kind of gave me financial freedom to where I have this set amount of money each month that covers my basic expenses. And then I can I don't have to like get a job just to make ends meet type of thing. And so I was able to put all my energy into starting to relearn how to make knives. And then slowly, first I was, for the first year and a half, 2 years, I was just working on kind of getting my flow back and starting to get pretty much to where I was in terms of being able to make and physically sit up in my chair and stuff for that long. And so it took a while to be able to get my stamina back. And then once I was there, I started wanting to improve the quality, trying more complicated projects. And then it wasn't until I started dating my now wife, it's Rich that I was talking about earlier. It's her daughter, or his daughter. But he kind of wanted to talk to me, and he was like, well, do you want to make this, is this like a business that you want to do? After we started dating, he was like, is this like a business that you actually want to pursue, or what do you want out of it, pretty much? And it made me think, and I was like, well, I want to make this like an actual business that is my thing and stuff like that. And so he was like, okay, well, then you should. I pretty much ended up doing a soft reboot with my Fennec model to where I kind of cut out all of the stuff that I was doing before and just kind of restarted focusing on one design. I did 11 or 13 different iterations of this one design to get it how I wanted it. And then kind of built from there, slowly building up different models with different blade shapes, but I still kind of kept the similar handle style, so it kind of looks like it's all one family of knives.
I wanted to talk to you about that, which is one of the things that I think I was kind of going through your work, and three of the knives that I was looking at, they're really kind of incredibly striking. They're all really well done. All your fit and finish is great. Your decision making, I love the liners, I love the wood, I love the shapes. The Tempest is a really extraordinary looking knife. It has a sweeping curve down, almost like a toucan's beak or something like that.
Yeah,
that's just a really beautiful knife. The Corsair, which is almost as if I was wondering, even though I'm sure the answer is no, is like it's almost as like it's the opposite of the Tempest, where the blade almost, I could imagine if you put the Tempest down and the Corsair up, man, I wonder if those sweeps match almost.
Yeah, I got you.
And then the Nomad, which is this incredible skinning knife. It really is really stunning. Your designs are beautiful. Your fit and finish is amazing. You do an awesome belt finish. I really, really think that you're a complete package regardless of your story. Where did you kind of figure out all these different designs?
So I did a lot of looking around on different stuff. I just kind of took out first when I was developing the Fennec. I wanted to start out and say, like, my first question was, what's the knife shape that kind of appeals to most people's wants? And for me, when I thought of it in terms of not culinary knives, but like EDC outdoor type stuff, I thought like a drop point was a good place to start because that's like kind of the most basic standard knife shape. And so I started out with that blade shape. I was like, I want to make a drop point knife, but I want to add a design element that makes it unique, not just like every other knife that looks like it or with that blade shape. And so I started looking at different handles, but a lot of full tang knife handles are kind of similar. Like they have like either like the Coke bottle shape or yeah, they're not very curved and stuff like that. And so I was like, well, these are really nice and they're comfortable, but they look all the same for the most part, which is fine. There's a reason why they all look the same, is because they're all comfortable. But I started looking at like folding knife handles.
Oh yeah.
And so that's how I kind of, a lot of really high-end folding knives has that like double finger choil that I have in a lot of my knives currently.
It's like the first two fingers, it steps down into the blade and then it kind of comes back up.
Yeah.
After your second finger. Yeah.
Yeah. And so it kind of, that little corner in between those two different contours separates your pinky and ring finger from your middle and pointer finger. And so that was kind of the thing that I was like, all right, this, I like this a lot. And so I took that handle shape and made, not the same knife, the handles are changed slightly, but they kind of all kept that same basic handle shape with the double finger choil. And then, so now that I kind of got where I wanted to with that, I have a knife with pretty much that shaped handle in every blade shape. And now I'm kind of getting to the point where I could start branching out into more unique models and stuff like that. I wanted to get a baseline of kind of, if you want a Persian style knife, like with a Corsair that's really upswept, I got one like that. If you want something more kind of interesting looking, kind of like the Tempest, it'll be, that's kind of based off like a lineman's knife. It's almost like a Karambit, but not quite. It's got the hawksbill blade. But I kind of have one for everything, and now I can start branching out and doing more.
I love the handle design. I like that drop down into the handle and the first two fingers. I also like your termination point of the bolster where it's that angle. That's like that angle. I know that Don Nguyen does something on the similar side, mm-hmm. In terms of that kind of, it's a trickier decision. It's trickier to make for the knife maker to have your bolster have like an angle to it, because you know, you're dealing with more than just rounding off the top. Mm-hmm. But what I notice is now that I look at, after what you said, and I look at all your knives, all the blades feel appropriate to the handle.
Yeah.
Like all of them really feel as though they were, it's not an afterthought where you're, and before you said that, I never thought, he's just making the same handle and he's throwing different blades on. They all are very appropriate to the design decisions. I think that your design decision is very, very thoughtful, intelligent.
Thank you.
So are you feeling, and I know that, you know, on Knife Talk, I know that we sent you some messages through the podcast when you were in the hospital and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what I've noticed is, and I know we talked about it on Knife Talk throughout while you're in hospital and afterwards. One of the messages, you know, you were saying in the beginning, you didn't want to send too many messages because it, you know, you don't want to beat a dead horse, you know, with a question of grip progression. Mm-hmm. One of the questions we get so much is, when I come to the shop, I'm not motivated. Or when I come to the shop, I don't know what to do first. Or when I get to the shop, I'm not inspired. And then I think about that, and there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, everybody's different. Everybody's experiences are different. Everybody's background's different. Their walk of life is different. Mm-hmm. And then nowadays, I always think about it as just like, well, look at Jaden. Jaden, here's a guy who was starting in and his youth was cut short with this accident, and he's so positive. And I just don't know how, I mean, it feels as though that you're very happy. And one of the things I don't know if I heard you say it or you said it, this is the happiest you've ever been.
Yeah.
You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, it is. I mean, I have, since the accident, my business has definitely upgraded. I've gotten, my business has improved in pretty much every way. I got married. I have a house. I own a house. Like all that stuff. I think of, kind of a story that's really helped me through a lot of this is the story of Sisyphus from Greek mythology. Yeah.
Go ahead.
And so it's this guy who always outsmarts the gods. He's cheated death and stuff like that. And eventually, finally, the gods get him and they punish him to push this boulder up the hill. And there's a philosopher named Albert Camus, and he said that Sisyphus got back at the gods one last time by enjoying his punishment, pretty much. And
yeah, so the end of the story is Sisyphus, every time he pushes the rock up the hill, when he gets to the end, the rock falls back down the hill and he gets to start from scratch.
Yeah, and so that it, I don't see myself as Sisyphus, but I do like to think of that in times of struggle, like just get the boulder up the hill, just get through this. And so that's been a big help for me.
And you go to the gym in the mornings, you're working out. I see you, you know, working out. You just have this sense of like happiness.
Yeah. It's taken a long time to find like a clear kind of purpose and direction I want to go. And now that I have it, it's just full steam ahead. Make hay while the sun's shining.
Unbelievable. It's unbelievable. It's a story. I mean, your story is so positive, and it's just very, like, it's inspiring. You're very inspiring.
Thank you. I never want to, like, try to be an inspiration, but if people can find that in me, then I'm happy to help.
That's good. Yeah, don't be a guru. Yeah. So there's too many gurus out there. You don't need to be a guru. And it's, you know, the funny thing is it's always action. It's never talk.
Yep.
Talk is cheap. If people see you doing your, I love your Instagram content where you're talking, you know, you made some very funny ones about like what it's like being a paralyzed knife maker. And I feel like you have a very good sense of humor about it all. And it's, I love that content.
Thank you. I enjoy doing the Instagram stuff.
Have you gotten a lot of like messages that are, are you surprised at some messages that you receive or?
I've gotten a surprising amount of people like, kind of saying that their story or that my story is inspiring to them and stuff like that. And it always, I never know how to respond exactly because it's, I don't like necessarily be like being in the spotlight all the time, but I do. I'm glad that someone could get positivity out of it.
It's gotta be great. I mean, look, I know you don't want to feel, I know when I was a kid too, my dad used to say to me, just don't feel so good about yourself all the time. It's like, you know, you don't want to brag, you know, get comfortable, but you know, I think about you a lot in terms of just like inner fortitude and figuring out ways in which to kind of like get through. I mean, mental health is, especially with men, is really kind of a tough situation. And we have a lot of, through the podcast, you have no idea over the years how many messages people have sent us of like, you got me through some hard times and, you know, just being there and just talking like a normal person is. When somebody sees someone like you who's, you know, I talk about with Pat Quinn, you're able to see his evolution as a person, as an artist, and it's the same thing with you. You get to see the beginning stages when you were, you know, when you were starting in, and then you see, you know, from the hospital to how you're doing it now. It's just like, I feel like we're also part of your journey too, and it's just, you have a lot of fans out there.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And like, talking about the mental health stuff, if there's anybody who wants to shoot me a message or anything, like asking questions or anything like that, they're welcome to. I'm not going to give them like the David Goggins bullshit, but I'll talk them in any way I can.
You hear that, guys? He's not going to give you the David Goggins bullshit. I think that's fantastic. People just want to listen to what your story is, and then also, you know, realize that you're moving forward in a positive manner. Jaden, dude, this has been such a pleasure, and I'm glad you broke my balls in the beginning about you thought I was giving you the runaround. I was really legitimately thinking to myself, what's the best way to go? How do I help highlight his story? And I wanted to do you right. I didn't want it to be herky jerky, and I wanted it to be, you know, your story. And I'm really grateful that you're here. And I'm really proud to know who you are. And you've inspired me. That's for sure.
I appreciate that. You, all the boys at Knife Talk has helped me through a lot. So I've listened to pretty much every episode since you guys got on there. So it's pretty crazy.
It's crazy out there. Listen, dudes, guys, I'm going to put a link for Jordan's business is called Fox_River_Blades on Instagram. Are you anywhere else or just Instagram?
I'm on Facebook and also Reddit.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. Jeez. Yeah. It's a Reddit can be a little bit dicey sometimes. So.
I am too afraid. I'm too fragile, Jaden. I'm too fragile for a lot of them places. So I'm with you. So guys, I'm going to put a link to all of Jaden's website. Go check out his work. Read more about his story. Go to Fox_River_Blades on Instagram. Follow Jaden. He's fantastic. And Jaden, I'm really glad you're here.
Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, dude, it was a total pleasure. All right, guys. We're going to have Jaden back. And we're going to fuck around the next time. We got the origin story out of the way. We're going to fuck around with it the next time. Jaden, you're the man, and thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you very much.
All right, guys. We'll see you next week.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.